Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Everybody awake? All right, this one is called, we're going to do the reading, 2-minute meditation, and then the prayer. This one's called Oneness. If I break down the walls, I will be surrounded by the garden. If I break the levee, water will inundate me. Meditation is not to be separated from life. The task of following spirit is to cease all distinctions between the self and the outside world. It is only a matter of convenience that we label things inside and outside, subjective and objective. Indeed, it is only at elementary stages that we should talk of a spirit to follow. For true enlightenment is the realization that there is a spirit to follow, but that we ourselves are spirit. That understanding comes after a simple breaking down of a wall, a shattering of a mistaken notion that there is something inherent in life that divides us from spirit. Once the wall is broken, we are inundated by spirit. We are spirit. Do we continue to meditate once we come to this understanding? We still do, but it is no longer a solitary, isolated activity. It is part of life, as natural as breathing. When you can bring yourself to understanding that there is no difference between you and spirit, and that there is no difference between meditation and ordinary activities, then you are well on your way to being one with spirit. Meditation. Prayer.
Father, please lay aside everything I think I know about this weekend. The big book, Alcoholism, Addiction, 12 Steps, myself, and especially you, God, so I may have an open mind and a new experience. Help me see the truth. Amen.
Anybody in here like instant gratification? Earmarks of a real alcoholic or real addict that they want it all now. And there's a certain assumption that all of you have made that you don't know that you've actually made. Is that Tarek and I one day walked in that door and we came and we sat here. And that's all that happened. And so early in your recovery, you're going to walk in that door and you're going to want to know why you're not sitting up front. What all that stuff that those guys were talking about, all that reading I just read about meditation and becoming one with meditation in the daily, is that, it sounds like that's so simply achieved. And when you start down the path and you don't get it instantly, something within you might say, well, this doesn't work. Well, the reality is that we may have walked in that door, and then we walked over there, then we went into that room, then we went into the kitchen, then we came around a couple of the tables, then we went back out, came back in. And the path to the place where Tarek and I are sitting today wasn't a straight line. It was all jumbled up and squiggly, and there were parts of it that may have been straight, but what we're giving you is the pathway through the steps to get from where you are now to a place that looks very similar to where we are, but it's not going to be where we're at. Because the reality is, by the time you get to where we are, we're already somewhere else. And that our life goal, both of ours, I didn't say it last night, I usually say it. If you meet me a year from now and I'm the same person, I failed. I have two wonderful parents that have been married for 50 years. They're just wonderful, kind people. And you meet them 10 years ago or 10 years from now, they're the same people. And that's fine for them. That works for them. But because I'm a seeker, I always sought out the best party. If I was into the dope, I would have sought out the best dope. So for me today, I'm constantly seeking to be somewhere out in the future that's better than I am right now. So if next year I'm the same person, I failed because I haven't grown. Because that's what I'm here for, is growth, constant growth, perpetual growth. And I'll tell you from my own experience, and Tara can speak from his own, it's really kind of exponential. The more you stay on this path, the more that you focus on it, the cool stuff goes faster, comes to you quicker. The more power that flows out of you, the more power that flows into you, and it creates this just energy field that you exist in. I'm sitting over there in meditation. I could have told you I was sitting right here. Some of the stuff that I was experiencing from over here and then over here. But that doesn't happen just by walking in the door. You have to do something. What we're trying to show you is how to do something and hopefully get you excited about going and seeking some more on your own.
So another question you'd have to ask yourself is, how much of this do you want? How much of what is available do you want? And what exactly are you willing to do to find out what that is? Is it just go to meetings? Maybe it is. Maybe that's your path. I don't know.
Is just being clean and sober enough for you?
Mm-hmm. I mean, clean and sober was never enough for most of the guys sitting in this room. We're a group of individuals that has to have an effect produced. That's why we're sitting here. And Brandon described the effect produced by the spiritual path for us. But it requires commitment. It requires sacrifice. Requires discipline. And it's not attained through fellowship alone. which is a very nice segue into page 17 in your big book. See, we are people that normally would not mix. They tell the story about a ship and the people on the ship escaping disasters. So whenever I think about this page, I recall the movie The Titanic. You've got all these people on the ship and they're separated by class. Right? The iceberg does not discriminate. Right? The iceberg is just the iceberg. Addiction is just addiction. Doesn't care what your background is, doesn't care what your religion is, doesn't care how old you are, male, female, it does not respect any of that. So the iceberg appears, and everyone on that ship, regardless of what class they're in, has the same problem, common problem. I got to get off this ship before it sinks. Several hundred of them get off the ship and they go to this other ship. And as soon as they get to the other ship, they start separating everybody by class again. So having experienced a common peril or a common problem wasn't enough to hold them together. So if we go to the second full paragraph on 17 and go four lines from the bottom, it says the feeling of having shared in a common peril, addiction, alcoholism, is one element in the powerful cement which binds us. But that element by itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we absolutely agree. The first 100 that wrote this book, they agreed. There's no longer absolute agreement, brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism and addiction. So there's a warning here. And there's a question here. Is the fellowship by itself enough for you to stay clean and sober? It's not enough for me. I can only answer that question for me. I cannot stay sober off the fellowship. I tried it. It did not work for me. I know people that go to the room, are in the rooms, and it works for them. But then I would love an opportunity to sit down and see where they fall on the type 1, 2, 3, 4. So there's a magical combination here of problem and solution. The first layer of healing that you and I experience is going to a meeting and hearing part of our story. I mentioned this last night, I believe. But if talking about our experience with addiction and alcoholism was enough to keep us sober, all the guys under the bridge downtown Atlanta that are living under the bridge and talking about their common problem, that'd be enough to keep them clean and sober, but it's not. We need to have a common problem and then a common solution, because that's where the depth and the weight is. The reason you are sitting and paying attention to Brandon and I is that we have depth. We have experience. Somewhere between 4 o'clock yesterday evening, or early evening, late afternoon, and this morning, we convinced most of you in this room that we have gone where you have gone, to the gates of insanity and almost death, and for whatever reason, we've been brought back to tell a story. That's the experience. That's the depth. The weight is not only have we come back to tell a story, but we found an answer.
Does it look like Tarek still struggles with crack cocaine today?
No.
Anyone else? So he's found something, right?
I remember the days of asking myself if I was going to have to smoke crack for the rest of my life. I didn't want to smoke anymore, and I kept smoking. I didn't want to drink whiskey anymore, and I kept drinking. So, you know, in Bill's story, Bill talks about he saw something in his friend and he asked himself if he would have it. He said, of course I would. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, Bill might build what he saw in his friend. That foundation of complete willingness comes from your experience with the first step, the powerlessness. The foundation, when you're in construction, when you go find a foundation to build a building, you have to find cement and you pour the mixture into the foundation. Or the cement here is a magical combination of problem and solution. So you can't have an all-problem meeting. We all know how sick those are. But you can't have a straight-up 100% solution meeting either. You have to have a magical combination of the two. Here's my problem, here's my struggle, and here's the solution. What do? We end up going to a lot of meetings where all they talk about is problem, 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 problem.
Traffic equates to a problem. So if you're in a meeting and they're bitching about traffic, that's a problem meeting.
Let's turn the page. So what do problems sometimes look like? So this paragraph at the top of page 18 is going to describe us when we first get here in terms of what happens in our progression of alcoholism and drug addiction. But this can also happen to you sober and dry. An illness of this sort, alcoholism, addiction, we've come to believe it's an illness, involve those about us who know like no other human sickness can. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him and no one is angry or hurt. But not so with the addict and alcoholic illness. For with it, there goes all annihilation of all things worthwhile in life and engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers, the addict or the alcoholic. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents. You can keep increasing the list. Every single one of those things that are listed in that paragraph, my addiction took me to. My alcoholism took me there. You know, alcoholism and addiction says to Tarek, if you want to hang out with me, I need to annihilate everything that's worthwhile in your life. I need to touch everyone who's close to you. I'm going to bring fierce misunderstanding. I'm going to bring you financial insecurity. I'm going to strip you of your friends. I'm going to strip you of your employers. I'm going to strip you of your children. I'm going to strip you of your respect. I'm going to strip you of integrity. I'm going to strip you of your manhood. I'm going to strip you of your home. And we can hang out. Now you come into the 12 steps and the spiritual path, it's also going to require you to do some things. Isn't it fascinating what your buddy wants from you to hang out versus what the 12 steps require of you? If you're comparing the two and you have a child, it's like kissing your child on the cheek, what the 12 steps will ask of you versus what your buddy is going to ask of you.
Your buddy being your drug of no choice.
Let's turn to page 19, bottom. This here encompasses part of our solution and the attitude we have to carry into life moving forward. It's one of the ways that the steps in this program that's outlined in this book is set up, because we're individuals that spend a lot of time thinking about us. You guys have seen the movie Alien. You remember the one alien that attaches itself to the face and all, that's all you've got. This is you on you. This is me on me. That's all I see. This is the problem. The drugs and the alcohol are not the problem. The problem is I think about myself too often. My little plans and designs. And so at the bottom of 19, it gives you a wonderful passage to explain to you what your life has to become. Most of us sense that real tolerance for other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions are attitudes which make us more useful to others. Now here's a question to ask yourself. Do you believe your life as an ex-problem drinker or drug user depends on the constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs? there's a question, you know. Write in your book, D-I-B, do I believe? That's what D-I-B means. Do I believe that my life has to become about the constant thought of others, the constant thought of God, and how I may help meet others' needs? Ask yourself if you've relapsed. You've been relapsing over and over. Have you ever reached a place where your life centered on this? Believe it or not, when you center your life on this, you have now begun to live a God-centered life. All right. But we have so many warped ideas about God based on what we've grown up with, none of which are true. Even the beliefs I have about the universe and the cosmos and my beliefs around God and the galactic power of God, I don't know if that's right. I know it creates some really powerful synergy in my life. And I have the presence and the awareness to exist in a state of consciousness where I don't think about smoking crack anymore or drinking whiskey. And a lot of my life has now been devoted to the constant thought of others and how I can help meet their needs. Does that mean I don't struggle with selfishness and self-centeredness? No. But I'm trudging forward in a direction that says everyone must get theirs first. Right? The best definition of spirituality that I've ever heard is enlightened self-interest. The best way for Tarek to get his is to make sure everyone else gets theirs first. That could be true. That could be a lie. It doesn't matter. If it's a lie, it's a lie that makes me a better human. So, ask yourself these questions. So the passage I just read is only going to apply to you if you fit the description on page 21. We'll start at the bottom of 20. I'm not going to spend a lot of time with moderate, because if you're sitting at the Bridges of Hope, I'm thinking you passed moderate. There's not much you do moderately. Maybe there is. I'm not a moderate kind of guy. Let's look at the certain type of hard drinker or hard drug user. He may or may not have a habit that badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. So let me ask myself a question. Did my habit with alcohol impair me physically and mentally? I would say if with alcohol it impaired me mentally. I don't know about the physical as much. I had exhibited loss of control, but I never experienced DTs. Right? I never woke up having to have a drink to function. Where I see the physical ramifications of alcohol is when I used to go to happy hour. And I'd go into the bar after work when the guys came to my office and say, hey, let's go grab a couple of drinks. And I'd walk up to the bar and I'd say, let me get a Budweiser, let me get a Jim Beam. And I'd start drinking. About 7 o'clock, the individuals that I came to the bar with, they're closing their tabs and they're going home. And I'm not. And the effect produced in me was much different than the effect produced in them. I mean, I would be visibly intoxicated and sometimes showing my ass with individuals I came to the bar from work, and they're like nursing a couple of beers. They literally just came to have a few drinks. I came to get right. I came to get right. And so I see that. Next, it says, it may cause you to die a few years before your time. I didn't die, so that doesn't apply to me. Do I think it could have? Yes. If a sufficiently strong reason like ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or warning from a doctor. So I had some health problems. I had a girlfriend that wanted me to stop. I tried to hang out with different people. I went to the ER based on some complications from my drug use, and I left the ER and went straight back to what I was doing. All of those became operative, but I could not stop or moderate. So that happened to me with alcohol, and that happened to me with drugs. But I'm not the hard drinker or the hard addict, because I had all those situations become operative and I could not stop or moderate. So I got to be something else. So let's go to the next guy.
Well, before we move on, so I had a buddy in college that he stayed up with me all night, partied all night. He was the puke and rally guy. Like we would be at a bar, and if Kevin disappeared, you knew he was getting sick, but you knew it was. You always knew he got sick if he left for a little while and he came back and he ordered shots for all of us. Because he was going to prove to us that he wasn't out, right? So Kevin would do this. He'd go get sick. He'd come back, order the shots. He would then stay partying with me the rest of the night. Now, I don't know about you guys, but when I found this way of life, I wanted to convert everybody I knew that had a problem with drinking and make them stop and show them the way, right? Like I was with you before, now I want you to be with me, right? So I call him to kind of do a little assessment on him. Hadn't really been hanging out with him much because he lived a little further away. So I started asking him, so like, how many nights a week do you go out still? It's like, oh, I don't really go out anymore. I'm like, okay, well, do you just hang around the neighborhood and drink? No, you know, Danielle's out of town a lot, and the kids have chess club, and I'm kind of like Mr. Mom, and you know, I got to get them to baseball and stuff like that. So, you know, I just really don't have time to drink. I'm like, so what? You just like wait for a good weekend and really tear it up? And he goes, dude, I'm usually asleep well before I would even have an opportunity to get tore up. And I'm like sitting there listening to this guy going, wait a minute. This is the same guy that used to puke and rally and would stay up with me all night long. But if a sufficiently strong reason, chess club, Mr. Mom, you know, carpool, whatever it was, came about, what'd he do? He grew up. He did the one thing that everybody always was waiting for me to do. Just put it down, move on. So he was a hard drinker. He had a habit, but he kicked it with chess club. I kept on. So look at the people in your life and try to figure out if you, like, you see them do it, you try to do what they do, but then when you really assess them, you'll find out that they're not like you. They're completely different from you.
So let's look at the real addict or the real alcoholic on page 21. I'll use myself. You know, I didn't start off as a moderate drinker, really, a periodic drinker, but I saw loss of control early on. I never really became a continuous hard drinker. I drank a lot, and I lost control a lot, but I don't even know if I'd qualify as a hard drinker. But at some stage, I reached this point where I began to lose all control of my liquor consumption once I started. So, I mean, I'm very fortunate for those. I was an analyst for a couple of years, and there was a bar right across the street from our office building, and we would go there a lot after work. And a lot, many times my intent walking into the bar was to get a couple of drinks and go home. And I could not control the amount that I drank. My intent when I walked into those bars was not to overshoot the mark. It was not to end up in a crack house in the middle of the week where I got to go to work the next day. When I looked at drugs, this not being able to control once you start, I had it for heroin. I had it for a lot of the, you know, I loved Klonopin. I loved, you know, the painkillers. I loved Xanax. I loved Valium. If I had them, I could not control the amount that I did. And I also had this for alcohol, and I had it for cocaine. I get that specific about what substance I did that I could not control. Now, you put some meth in front of me. I mean, I smoked a lot of meth, and I used it to stay up, but I could literally control it for some reason. I could almost like take it or leave it. It's fascinating to me, but that's just the way it was with it. It just did not ring my bell, so to speak. And so I find myself in these pages. I am physically a real alcoholic and a real drug addict for many substances. And once we get to the mental, you'll understand why I'm specifying the way I am. Two stories I want to tell you. I had a girlfriend. She taught me how to cook cocaine. And she looked just like me. She drank like me. She actually drank more alcoholically than I did. She smoked crack like I smoked crack. She'd stay up for days with me. She looked just like me. And at the end of 2005, we separated, and her dad came into our life. He was the sufficient reason, a successful surgeon. Comes into our life and says, if you don't leave this guy, no more money, you got to move home right now, finish nursing school, do your deal, grow up. You know, she's married, has a kid, she has a master's in nursing now, she hasn't smoked crack since. But I would have given you my right arm that she was just like me, but she wasn't. The hard addict or the hard alcoholic or the hard drinker looks very much like a real addict and alcoholic sometimes. One other story. We were at the bar I've been talking about with two of my friends, and we all overshot the mark drinking, and we couldn't get any powder, so we decided to pull our money together, and I went downtown and bought several $100 worth of crack, and we went back to my house, and we started smoking and playing music and drinking, and there's a pile of crack on the table, right? So the big book says that the effect produced in me is quite different. So we start smoking, and there's nothing in existence anymore. All I see is a pile of crack on the table. My friends are over here socializing. They're socializing and cutting up and having a good time. I can't even talk. And when I do talk, I whisper when I'm smoking crack. You can't understand a damn thing that comes out of my mouth. And so I'm sitting there puffing and puffing, and then the crack is gone, and I start pacing around the house. I'm pacing and I'm slamming liquor so I can calm down, so I can get behind the steering wheel of my car and go back downtown. And so I'm walking around the house and I'm trying to convince them to give me more money so I can go downtown. And they said, no, man, we're good. We've got alcohol. We've got pot. We've got music. We've got some Valium. We're good. We're just going to sit and chill, watch the sun come up, and have a good time.
What's wrong with you?
And so I hopped in my car. I ended up hanging out in a crack house for a few days. The effect produced to me was quite different. These two guys, one of them is an attorney, and the other one owns a business. And I just went out to dinner with him 2 weeks ago. He's a business owner. He grew out of that phase of his life, believe it or not. He used to smoke crack. He was a recreational crack smoker.
He could smoke crack like a gentleman.
Yeah. Straight up. And so it's interesting to reflect on your experience and see where you fall on these pages. That's why I do that exercise. I'm not the hard guy with alcohol and a lot of drugs.
All right, so guys, in combination with the four types and two wives, using this, you can bust up somebody that's not supposed to be hanging out in the rooms. And this is why this idea of showing up to a treatment center or a meeting, you've done your first step, is a bunch of horseshit, in my opinion. I'll explain to you why. So this guy, we'll call him Josh, because that was his name. And so Josh is doing some work with me, and I know who his sponsor is, and his sponsor hasn't worked any steps, but he's an old guy that's got a bunch of money and looks good in a meeting. And so this guy's sponsoring Josh. And I'm talking with Josh because Josh seems strangely normal now that the alcohol is out of his system. Like, his unmanageability, he doesn't really seem to have a whole bunch of resentments. Nobody's really pissing him off. Life doesn't seem real hard. Like, he's gotten dry, not worked a step, and he's like one of the happiest people around. And it's just like, what the fuck's wrong with this dude, right? And so I start challenging him. I'm like, so why do you think you're an alcoholic? And he said, because I go to meetings. I'm like, bullshit, that's not enough for me. What? Why are you an alcoholic? And he's like, because I say I am? I'm like, okay. So I took him through the four types, and when we got to type one, I got a kind of out of type one. Well, that's kind of me. I went through the four types, got to the end, and I'm really confused. And I'm like, all right, so do you really think you're an alcoholic? He's like, isn't that like sacrilege to say in the rooms of AA that somebody might not be an alcoholic? I'm like, no, dude, if you don't have to work these steps, you don't have to go to these meetings, why the fuck would you be here? And he's like, well, because I'm supposed to be. I'm like, why are you supposed to be? He goes, because I would go out with my buddies every night and we would have like 10 or 12 beers. And I said, okay, and then what would happen when you got home? Well, I'd go out with my buddies and I'd have 10 or 12 beers. I don't care what happened in the bar. When you got home, what'd you do? I don't know. Did you keep drinking? No. Okay. So then I went through moderate, hard, and real alcoholic, and I started asking, there's more questions down here underneath the in the next paragraph. Are you the person that does tragic things while drinking? Not really. Are you a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde? Are you different drinking than when you're not? No, I'm pretty much the same person. We went through all this stuff, and we got to the end, and I'm like, dude, you're not an alcoholic. But he's been sold this idea that he shows up in a meeting, and therefore he must be alcoholic. Okay, this is a big problem if he tries to sponsor somebody like you and I. He tries to sponsor a real alcoholic and he tells him, well, just go to church. It's going to kill that guy. So these pages coupled with two wives, you can find out a lot about yourself, and you can find out a lot of, like, if you go through this and the guy gives you a kind of, don't waste your time. Maybe he is a potential, but maybe he needs to wreck his life some more before he can be convinced that he actually has the problem.
Hmm. You want to go? Page 22. So, you know, they go through the Dr. Jekyll and the Mr. Hyde, and they give you some common behaviors of alcoholics and addicts. So why is it we attempt a desperate experiment of this first drink? So I'm reading. I'm going to start at the second full paragraph. It says, why do guys like us behave like this? If hundreds of experiences have shown us that one drink or one drug means another great disaster, debacle, with all its attendant suffering and humiliation, why do guys like us take the first drink or the first drug? Why can't we stay stopped? That's what on the water wagon means. What has become of our common sense and willpower that we still sometimes display with respect to other matters? Perhaps we're never going to find a full answer to this question. There are opinions that vary considerably as to why addicts and alcoholics react differently from normal people. We are not sure why. Once a certain point is reached, the line in the sand there's this imaginary line in the sand that we cross, and we never ask ourselves what side of the line we're on until we're way on the other side. And then we look back and be like, damn, what was that thing I hit back there? That was the line.
Right by it.
Little or nothing can be done. We can't answer the riddle. So we know while the addict and the alcoholic, guys like Tarek and Brandon, keep away from drinking and drugging, as we may do for months, sometimes weeks, months, or years. It was never years for me, but there were some weeks in there. I react much like other people. I don't know if I really agree with that sentence. We are equally positive that once Tarek and Brandon take any alcohol and drugs into their system, something happens, both in the body and in the mind, which makes it virtually impossible for us to stop. My experience with alcohol and drugs abundantly confirms this. You guys hear the talk about the physical craving and the phenomenon of craving and the allergy a lot. And for years, I'm thinking, my physical craving is in the body all the time. You guys realize that the mind, the brain, is an organ in the body? That our abnormal physical reaction happens in the mind? Now, I get with opiates you become physically addicted, but I don't know about you guys, but I had a complete psychic change after I put some drugs and alcohol in my system. The mind completely transformed. I would have a personality change. The abnormal reaction happened in the mind. It's an organ that's part of the body. Okay, that's why the book says here, once we introduce it in our system, something happens both bodily and mentally. But see, the problem for you and I is we commit the most insane act of our life based on our experience with drugs and alcohol from a state of consciousness that we call sobriety. So I used to take a meeting to a treatment center, and I'd get a bunch of new clients in the treatment center, and I'd always say, what's the most insane thing that you've ever done associated with drugs and alcohol? And without fail, they would go down the line and tell me some crazy war story of something they did under the influence. And it was a trick question. I'd say, no. based on your experience with drugs and alcohol and all of the havoc that it creates, the most insane act that you commit is the fact that you take the first one. And you do that from a state of consciousness called sobriety or being clean. So these observations that we've made for the last five sessions are academic and pointless, really. If Tarek and Brandon just took are academic and pointless if our friends never took the first drink, therefore setting the terrible cycle in motion. The main problem that Tarek and Brandon have centers in the mind rather than the body. If you ask one of us while we started on our last bender or our last run, we're going to offer you 100 alibis and 100 excuses, but the most common answer, most truthful answer, when my family and friends would look at me and say, "Why did you do that?" was, "I don't know. I don't know." And that's the baffling feature of addiction and alcoholism. The utter inability to stay away from the first one, no matter how great the necessity or the wish not to. That's it. And then I love this sentence on the middle of 23. It doesn't say that Tarek and Brandon once in a while lie, right? It says guys like us tell the truth once in a while. That's a pretty revealing way to write it. You should take some time to ponder on that. So I'm going to turn it over to Brandon now.
Take a break. And then come back and get choice.
Let me knock out. I can knock choice out of them.
Lose them a little bit.
Okay, let's take a 20-minute break. Come back at 9 o'clock.